Well, welcome everybody. This Lotus Sutra is the Bible of Buddhism. It's called the King of the Sutras. And this is where all of our Bible stories come from. You know, the burning bush, the prodigal son, all the stories that we grew up with in our Judeo-Christian system. We've got plenty of those stories there. It's a sutra in Technicolor. It's filled with furniture made of gold and chairs and thrones flying in the air, flowers coming down from the sky. It's kind of got everything. That's okay. And you know, I was thinking when in Sesshin we talked a lot about suchness, the Dongshan's view of suchness, and we got kind of big. When I am completely present in this space and my heart is open and my mind is still, I have the sensation of being of realizing, you know, my connection to the universe, to the big space. And we go from our, you know, driving the car to get here. We go from chopping the vegetables for the dinner before we're here and getting in our car to pretty defined, small, doable tasks. And then we come sit down, and frequently my experience is that everything is just more spacious. And if I were to draw a picture of that, I mean, Katagiri Roshi said, you have to say something about it. But if you were to draw a picture about it, how do you draw that hugeness, that connection? The compilers of the Lotus Sutra, you know, did it in real technicolor. And to be able to express that kind of largesse and the value. We talked about why we keep coming back here over and over again to this practice of sitting still, maybe a few aches and pains in our back or our joints. We come back because of that open-hearted spaciousness. And how might one depict that, you know, in a drawing or a movie? And it doesn't surprise me that it's done with such color and largesse as it's done here in the Lotus Sutra. So it's been out. One of the first English translations, you know, was this Kern translation, which I think was done in the 1800s. And is pretty much like the King James Version of the Bible. Lots of old words, thus and thou and thine. The Burton Watson translation is pretty modern. And then the latest one, and this is the one that Catherine used when she taught the Lotus Sutra. Like the year before she died, she was maybe a couple of years, she was going down to Monterey and teaching this. And it was the first time. She did lots of study with this, and she took a class in it. There's a teacher up at the university who actually was ordained in the Chan tradition, and he teaches philosophy. And Catherine got to know him, and she took a class from him on the Lotus Sutra. And I think this is the one that the latest translation is a very modern translation. So
Gene Reeves,
yeah. So you know, it's one of these. There's no requirement that you have the book or a book, but I think in terms of your Buddhist library, people should get at some point a Lotus Sutra of their choosing to have it in there. Dogen, you know, was before he brought Soto Zen back to Japan from his trip to China at age 25. But, you know, when he went into the monastery in his early teen years, he went into a Tiantai monastery, which the Tiantai school of Buddhism is based on the Lotus Sutra. So Dogen was well versed in the Lotus Sutra, and his fascicles are filled with references to the Lotus Sutra. So a deeper understanding of Dogen comes with knowledge of the Lotus Sutra. So it's not different than what we study. It's putting what we study to technicolor brightness, to a different world. Thich Nhat Hanh, this is a nice commentary, Opening the Heart of the Cosmos. This has been available for the last 10 or 12 years. This is a nice commentary to the Lotus Sutra, and is done in the way that Thich Nhat Hanh does things so well. Very approachable, very understandable. Opening the Heart of the Cosmos. He says that this is the Lotus Sutra is preached from the vantage point of ultimate reality, from that space. But and this Thich Nhat Hanh pretty much goes through the Lotus Sutra chapter by chapter and gives his understanding of the Lotus Sutra. So the Lotus Sutra is very much part of our Mahayana tradition. And just kind of a quick review of the history of all things and all things Buddhist. The 40 years of teaching, the 45 years of Buddha's teaching in the world with his disciples at hand are sometimes called the original Buddhists, or the original Buddhist teaching, with the voice hearers, the Shravakas, which were his disciples. Lasted the course of his lifetime, which was approximately 2,500 years ago. For those, what was it? He was in his mid-30s to 80, so 45 years is his traditional thought of as his traditional teaching life. And then for the next 300 years, the followers of his followers practice pretty much in that same tradition. And the key piece of that teaching was, can we look at the desires that come up in our life that we hold on to tightly, and can we give up those desires one after another? Can we kind of burn up those desires completely? And when we've burnt up those desire after desire, when we've opened the hand of thought of those desires and our karma, then you entered nirvana. It was a personal practice that people took on to reduce suffering in their lives and to encourage others to take up the practice so that they might also be liberated from the suffering in their life that the Buddha said in the Four Noble Truths, what the suffering was caused by craving for the grasping on tightly to our desires. So it was a personal practice, but certainly nobody was keeping people out of being a monk. But you pretty much had to, the teaching was you had to kind of become a monk to really do this practice completely. And then when you became an arhat, this senior student that has burnt up all of your desiring nature, you when you died, you entered nirvana and didn't have to come back again to be born again into this life. If you did pretty well in your lifetime, you know, your life would be a little better when you were born into it the next time. And maybe finally you would be born into a body that became a monk. And you were getting close then. You were getting close to kind of burning up all of your many lifetime karma. And so this was the Buddhist teaching for those first 200 or 300 years after Buddha's death. But then, you know, things change. Even in those after Buddha's death, the many different schools of Buddhism developed during those 200 or 300 years. They kind of focused schools that would focus on different aspects of the Buddha's teaching. So that there were even different ways, you know, that were proposed to focus on your liberation of practicing Buddhism. So sometimes those 200 or 300 years after Buddha died was called the schools period, where there were different schools of Buddhism. And then people started thinking, it was actually, people were quite devoted, it is said, to Buddha's relics, and there were stupas of Buddha's relics here and there, probably not too far from where Buddha died. And lay people, as well as the monks, were really devoted to taking care of these stupas of Buddha's relics. And lay people were learning Buddhism and practicing Buddhism. And that opening up of the Buddha Sangha to lay people as well as monks was a hallmark of the beginning of the Mahayana school of Buddhism, which started being practiced about 300 years after the Buddha's death, and the focus kind of shifted from a monk practicing for his personal liberation to saying, you know, this is how we should be looking at our lives. And I really want other people to know about liberation from suffering, and viewing the world with Buddha's eyes. So the focus shifted from practicing for your personal liberation to really helping others with their liberation and the beginning of the bodhisattva practice. Buddha told stories of himself being a bodhisattva, but in his many lifetimes, he was helping others in this world with their own liberation or pointing towards their liberation. He was helping others, but he was kind of the only bodhisattva for a few hundred years. And then with the growth of the Mahayana school of Buddhism, the bodhisattva ideal replaced the arhats practicing for their own salvation to the bodhisattva practice of liberating others, helping others with their liberation. And that practice started about 300 years after Buddha's death. Now, Buddha, the teachings of Buddha, the sutras, weren't written down for a couple of hundred years. Reportedly, you know, Ananda, one of Buddha's disciples, one of the Shravakas in Buddha's lifetime, Buddha's attendant for most of his teaching career, Ananda reportedly memorized all the words of the Buddha. And I guess people just kept memorizing for 300 years. You know, long after Ananda was gone, did anybody ever start writing down the sutras or Buddha's teaching? And so what do we think of that? You know, do you think they really memorized, you know, every word of the Buddha? Do you think maybe, you know, things... I'm sure people tried to do their best, but the whole idea of the Pali Canon, you know, being the exact words of Buddha, I think we have to think whether we believe that that people could do that. That there was a group of monks that just like Fahrenheit 451, you know, people memorizing a whole novel. You know, after all the books are burned, they quickly memorize a novel. Maybe you can memorize a novel, but can somebody memorize 45 years of Buddha's teaching?
I think so.
You know, maybe so.
I think so.
I heard that there were, like, one story is that there were these specialists in these five different Nikayas or collections of Buddha's teaching, and there was, like, the Diga Nikaya specialists that would memorize that section, and
yeah,
others
okay, yeah.
memorizing different pieces.
Yeah,
I
so recall when you specialize, you assign different parts to different.
You
there's a word.
There's a word that a boss uses to spread out the work.
Yeah.
You delegate.
You delegated to the
medium length, or delegated to the longer discourses. So you know, maybe that happened, but as a matter of fact, the Pali Canon was being written down at about the same time that the first Mahayana sutras that we also kind of think, we always kind of hope, they were given to us by the Buddha. There was also a delegation that was memorizing these first Mahayana teachings about bodhisattva practice and about emptiness. You know, emptiness is one of the hallmarks of Mahayana teaching. So the Mahayana sutras started appearing in the world about the same time as the original Pali Polycanon did. So as a matter of fact, the Prajnaparamita sutras of emptiness that includes the Diamond Sutra, those were the first Mahayana sutras that came out. The Avatamsaka Sutra that we chanted here a few weeks ago, the last part of the Avatamsaka Sutra, started coming out about then. The Vimalakirti Sutra started coming out around the time of the first century CE, the Common Era, or the first century before the Common Era. And of course, the Vimalakirti Sutra is the sutra expounding the Dharma by a lay person. So here's that Mahayana connection to Buddhism for everyone, and Buddhism focused on bodhisattva practice to help save all beings, to help liberate all beings. There's this Kokyo found a few commentaries on the Lotus Sutra in our library that I've got, so nobody can look at those. There's another commentary that that Gene Reeves edited, and it was a teaching of a Japanese scholar, a modern Japanese scholar, and he pointed out a scholar. I'll put my glasses on. In the 1700s, Nakamoto Tominaga, in the 1700s, a Buddhist Japanese scholar who kind of was looking at the progression of Buddhism and sutras, and he came up with this idea that's a pretty good one, I think, called development through accumulation, which is the idea that over time, practitioners of a religion or a philosophy kind of just keep building on an original idea based on how culture changes, how society changes, but it's all kind of based on a sincere practice. You know, it's not making up something new. It's just, you know, how does Buddha's teaching, you know, fit us now 300 years later, and how does it fit us 500 years later? As a matter of fact, you know, the story goes that the precepts that we study, Buddha's precepts, you know, weren't Buddha's, his ethical conduct for the Sangha wasn't the first thing that he taught. That the Sangha grew after several years, and a need arose in the community that had grown bigger for ethical teachings. So that, you know, in Buddha's lifetime, there was an example, for me anyway, of this development through accumulation of need as the community changes. And 300 years after the Buddha died, the community that was really wanting to practice Buddhism included lay people, included monks that had retired and were taking care of their elderly mothers, that weren't in the monastery anymore. And so those of us who were raised in Protestant churches, this was very much how Martin Luther and the other Protestant teachers started, the community of practitioners saw some need for, you know, let's take a look at the early teachings of Buddhism and see how it fits our lives, you know, now, you know, 1,000 years later or so. And we certainly think of the Protestant tradition as being kind of a valid expression of the teachings of Jesus. I mean, those who practice Protestant teaching. So I think this idea of the development through accumulation is an organic way of looking at how if perhaps Buddha didn't exactly say the words to the Mahayana sutras, that they were at least based on a sincere practice and a sincere study of Buddhism as it was practiced through the years. This this modern Japanese teacher that wrote this commentary, Introduction to the Lotus Sutra, in the 60s, that Gene Reeves has translated and edited. This modern teacher, there's a chapter in there that's actually called "The Buddha Did Not Say the Mahayana Sutras." He has an opinion about this. And he said, you know, us scholars have determined that it would have been impossible for the Buddha to say all of the Pali Canon and all of the Mahayana Sutras that are actually much bigger than the Pali Canon in 45 years. You know, so he wanted us to know this. Did I bring it? I'll have his name. He wanted us to know that even if the Buddha did not say these words, that it was built on sincere practice, a sincere grounding in Buddha's early teaching that was now being reflected in society as it changed and grew. And so we might all for ourselves decide, how do we want to look at the Mahayana sutras? How do we want to look at our Mahayana practice? Does it come directly from the Buddha? What does that mean for us? In Michael's class, we were talking about, you know, I think we're practicing a religion here. And what does it mean? Are we practicing the religion just as Shakyamuni Buddha taught it? Are we practicing a religion based on sincere practice of sages over the centuries? How do we think of this?
About sincere practice, I'm reminded of like Joseph Campbell when he talks about myths. You know, if you look at all the different myths in all the world, universally, there's this commonality. If you look at a lot of the myths, they're very similar, just different props, different people, different dress. It's all very similar. And so it finds its own way. It doesn't really matter so much how accurate the source is, but if it feels right, you know, then it seems to be, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Thich Nhat Hanh has an interesting take. He said that Buddha's teaching got a little dull in the monasteries, in the early monasteries. I mean, a sincere practice in the monasteries, a real dedicated study, you know, the Abhidharma, the Vinaya precepts, you know, a real hard look, but it certainly had a life for the monks studying it in the monastery, but for the people outside of the monastery, he says the Mahayana practice actually injected a certain liveliness and dynamism and room for growth. Is how Thich Nhat Hanh kind of looked at at how Buddhism and the practice of Buddhism grows and develops over the centuries. It was kind of vital that ultimately the practice spread outside of the monastery walls. So why don't we, we're about halfway through tonight's time, and I've got some visuals, we're actually going to be able to project some of this up on the wall, and it's pretty much set up. So,
really?
Yeah, it's all underneath, plugged in with computers, and so maybe if we'll turn it down a little bit after I make sure everything's plugged in, but I'm going to project it up there, and so some people can get up on the tons, and this group can sit right where that is. Let me plug in first. Then I'm going to sit there with where Charlie is sitting. So why don't you go here? And actually, yes. I don't know. So we actually have to pull that. So you might.
So where is everything?
Oh, you got it up.
Where is everything?
Only if we sing will we have music.
Oh, okay.
And if you could pull the extension cord out. And plug in. So the only reason I'm doing this is to save a little paper and not copy sections of the book. We can just sort of discuss things. There's kind of a warming up period I found. You can dim the. So far so good.
How's that?
Not bad. And we'll be able to read aloud. So this is Kokyo had a PDF of this whole book. Thank you very much, Kokyo. You're the multimedia bodhisattva. And I will need, if you could hand me the book and the pad, And then I'll need a little more light so that I can focus on what. So the Lotus Sutra came about, Nagarjuna referenced the Lotus Sutra in its the form that we pretty much know it in today. The 28 chapters of the Lotus Sutra, plus a short sutra in the beginning and the short sutra after. So it's sometimes called the Threefold Lotus Sutra. But Nagarjuna made reference to the whole thing in the 2nd century BC, or 2nd century CE, Christian era, common era. It was first translated from the Sanskrit to Chinese in 286 CE, and that translation didn't catch on. It was not reviewed much, but 200 years later, in the early 400s, Kumarajiva translated it again from the Sanskrit into Chinese, and that one really took off. And it seemed to be popularized throughout China and Japan and Korea, Eastern Asia. And interestingly, despite the fact that everyone says it's got this, you know, this whole kind of fantastic fantasy world that it's in, kind of is an Indian view of the world. Like you know, when you read Kazan's Lamp, you know, the Indian ancestors, you know, there's always, you know, mythical stuff happening. You know, the Indian ancestors are always being followed by 500 cranes, or the Indian ancestors are, you know, one of them was too old to become a Buddhist teacher, so the person that he wanted to teach with said, "You're too old." So he died, and then in his next life studied with that same teacher and then became the next ancestor. You know, there's always these fantastic stuff that's happening, and so people really do believe that it had Indian roots, but no Sanskrit version has ever been found. And of course, then there's the naysayers that say that it, you know, was invented in China, but people, the scholars say that it really has the roots of Indian working in it.
I thought maybe that the Kern translation is from the Sanskrit.
I didn't hear that.
It might be our Sanskrit.
Okay. Sometimes those sutras, though, were like back translated. They were only found in Chinese, but people have this idea that they probably were Indian, and so they were because this is given we chant the title of this in our meal chant. This is the Mahayana Sadharma Pundarika Sutra. So it's got a Sanskrit title, but I'll see if I can't find that out. Whether it is. Yeah. It is my understanding. Kokyo read something else. I like that Bollywood. Okay. So.
Well, this is Leon Hurwitz's introduction. He says, it's one of the few whose original text in the Buddhist Sanskrit survives.
Oh.
So, but yeah, it could be a back translation. I don't know.
Come on. Okay. So here's the table of contents. So it starts off with this this Sutra of Innumerable Meanings, a short Mahayana sutra that serves as kind of an introduction to the Sutra of the Lotus Flower of the Wonderful Dharma. And then the main sutra has 28 chapters. And then there's another short sutra of the contemplation of the Dharma practice of this universal sage Bodhisattva to kind of cap it off. It is thought that the sutra was put together over time in a couple of different pieces. Chapters 2 through 9 have a certain cohesion that they think is the earliest part of it. And then chapters 10 through 21, the language starts being a little different. It starts having a little different focus, and they think that that was put on later, along with chapter 1, that's called Introduction up there. So the second part was chapters 10 through 21, along with chapter 1, that kind of tied it all together. And then the last chapters, 22 to 28, are kind of life stories of certain bodhisattvas. So it has a certain focus on bodhisattva practice. And it was thought to be the third part that was added on. Chapter 20, the never disrespectful bodhisattva, is sometimes taught by itself as a single teaching. They thought it floated around by itself before the whole Lotus Sutra was put together. The one on 25, the universal gateway of the Bodhisattva regarder of the cries of the world, that's Avalokiteshvara. And that was taught by itself and may have had a life of its own before it was put together in the sutra. But it's pretty much been in this form, you know, since the earliest of days. It all kind of fit together in the 200s. Let's look at, so you've got to help me with my addition here. This says the pages on it, and I have to add 13. I want to look at the first sutra, Dharma teaching, page 33. So I'll go to page 46. Oh, there we are. Someone read the starting with World Honored One at the bottom of the top page, and then we'll go down further. Let me go up a little bit more. Someone start with World Honored One.
World Honored One, what is the gateway of the Dharma called? What does it mean? How does it, Bodhisattva practice it? The Buddha replied, "Good son, the unique gateway to the Dharma is called Innumerable Meanings. The Bodhisattva who wants to practice and study the gateway to the Dharma of Innumerable Meanings should observe that all things were originally, will be, and are in themselves empty and tranquil in nature and character, not large or small, not subject to arising or extinction, not fixed or movable, and neither advancing nor retreating like empty space. They are non-dualistic."
Okay, so that's pretty familiar. Mm-hmm. You know, there's, you know, all All things are empty and tranquil. They're not rising, they're not fading away, there's no characteristics. Those are some of the same words that we use when we looked at suchness in the Sashin. So this is that a gateway to innumerable meanings sutra. That's the kind of introduction sutra to this the Lotus Sutra. Now we'll go to the first chapter called the Introduction, 53 and 13 is 66. So this, the first chapter, the introduction, sets the stage. What's going on here? How is this? How is the Buddha presenting this? So someone, let's just read the first couple of paragraphs here, and I can.
Okay.
Is that a little clearer? Yeah. Okay, Kathy.
At one time, the Buddha was staying at Rajagriha on Holy Eagle Peak with a large group of great monks, 12,000 in all. All of them were arhats, without faults, free from afflictions, self-developed, emancipated from all bonds of existence, and mentally free. They included Ajnata Kalavinya, Mahakashyapa, Uruvirova Kashyapa, Daya Kashyapa, Mani Kashyapa, Shariputra, Maha Maudalya Yana, Maha Kakya Yana, Aniruta, Kathina, Gavam Aki, Yavaka, Kimin Davatsa, Bakula, Maha.
But we know some of these.
Yes.
We know some of these. There's Mahakashyapa,
yeah,
there's Sabuti, there's Shariputra.
There's Mahapajapati, and then
the second paragraph is the nun Mahapajapati was there with 6,000 of her followers, along with the nun Yasodhara, the mother of Rahula, and her followers. And then come so there's you know, 12,000 of the arhats, there's 6,000 at least of the nuns, and then there's 80,000 bodhisattvas, and we can look further.
That's kind of like the rainbow gathering.
Yes, it is. It starts listing them. Okay, here's the bodhisattvas. There's Manjushri. There's the next one, regarder of the cries of the world, is Avalokiteshvara. Maitreya is down there. Bhadrapala is our bath attendant. Bodhisattva is there. Can you translate any of the other ones, Kokyo?
There's Maitreya.
Well, yeah, there's Maitreya is down there. I mean, the whole works was there, and then there's Indra, king of the gods, was there, and 20,000 with his following of 20,000 children of heaven. You know, plus the and then we hear some of the children of heaven, rare moon, universal fragrance, jewel light. There's quite a crowd there. along with their following of 12,000 more children. The dragon kings, Nanda Dragon Queen, Upananda Dragon King, Sagara Dragon King, they've got good names, the Shimera Kings, Dharma Shimera King, Wonderful Dharma Shimera King, Great Dharma Shimera King, Upholding the Dharma, and several thousand of those. So quite a group. There's the centaurs, the griffins were there. The griffins. Yes, yes. Okay, now let's start reading. So we've got the invitation list there, and then start reading someone at the time. At the time, the world honored one. Can someone just jump in?
At that time, the world honored one, surrounded by the four virgins, gave offerings of years, prayers, and faith for the sake of all the bodhisattvas who taught the great beautiful teacher called Innumerable Meanings,
which is what we just looked at.
The Dharma by which bodhisattvas are taught, and which Buddhas watch over and keep always in mind. Having taught this teacher, sitting cross-legged, the Buddha entered the state of concentration called the place of innumerable meanings, in which his body and mind were completely motionless. The Mandarava, great Mandarava.
Then the Mandarava, the great Mandarava.
Manjushka and great Manjushka flowers rained down from the sky on the Buddha and the entire assembly, while the whole Buddha world trembled and shook in six ways.
So here was this whole, you know, many tens of thousands of beings. The Buddha was in a trance, was in a meditation after teaching this Mahayana Sutra about becoming a bodhisattva. He taught the sutra, he went into a meditation, and flowers started coming down from the sky, and the earth shook. A big earthquake. Okay, keep reading. Then the whole
congregation, monks and nuns, women and lay women, gods, dragons, sardars, centaurs, asuras, griffins, chimeras, pythons, humans and non-humans, as well as minor kings and the wheel-turning saintly kings, astonished because this had never happened before, with palms together and with complete attention, joyously looked up at the Buddha.
And Charlie, then what happened?
From the tuft of white hair between his eyebrows, one of his characteristic features, the Buddha emitted a beam of light, illuminating 18,000 worlds in the east, so that there was nowhere that it did not reach, down to the lowest purgatory and up to Akan-Itishka, the highest heaven. In those worlds, all the living beings in the six states could be seen. Likewise, the Buddhas existing at present in those lands could be seen. And the sutra teachings those Buddhas were preaching could be heard. Monks and nuns, laymen and laywomen who had attained the way to practice could also be seen. Further, one could see bodhisattvas, the great ones, walking the bodhisattva way due to various causes and conditions, with various degrees of faith and understanding, and in various forms.
Okay, so the earth shook, and then this light comes out of Buddha's forehead that illuminates this myriad of other Buddha fields, and there's a whole congregation in each one of those also listening to sutras being expounded upon. So this is quite an event that is happening here. This explication of the Lotus Sutra is happening to myriads right here on the Saha world, and the Buddha is pointing out it's happening simultaneously throughout all realms. So that's the setting, the stage for the Lotus Sutra. And then in chapter 2, we get into the Lotus Sutra proper. Seventy-five and thirteen is 88. The title of chapter 2 is called Skillful Means, Upaya, and it's kind of the main theme through chapters 2 through 9, Skillful Means. And we've heard this before. We've heard that the Buddha teaches people kind of on what they're able to hear. What's the term that Dogen uses, as far as our eye of practice can see? And we're encouraged to talk to people skillfully about the Dharma. You know, when I was working and I'd come back from a 5-day retreat, and with my head shaved, and you know, people would ask where I went on vacation, and I'd say, oh, you know, I did one of my Buddhist retreats again, and they'd go, oh, yeah, tell me about that, and you know, what do you say? What do you say about you know, does this person who has the cubicle next to you, you know, does he really want? Should I try to explain suchness? Or you know, do I mainly just say, you know, it's a great way to be with people. It's very nice to really, you know, kind of give your mind a rest. And you know, maybe that would bring him, you know, to check this out. You know, a little more than suchness. Or you know, if I, you don't. What were you saying in Michael's class? Your sister couldn't believe that you were chanting Japanese. You know, that didn't sound like your sister wanted to run right up to Green Gulch and start studying Buddhism. And you said, we're chanting in Japanese.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Can I get some synonyms for me?
Skillful ways.
Okay.
Skillful modes.
Okay. Methods.
Skillful methods.
Okay.
Yeah. Skillful methods. And so the Buddha, we're very grateful that he too was teaching his Dharma, you know, that was brand new. I think this modern Japanese scholar said, you know, actually, even the Buddha had based his teaching on some of the practices and the beliefs about the universe of his day. So maybe even the Buddha was building on something that was already there in the culture when he started. But certainly, the Buddha was started off teaching, you know, just what his five comrades could hear. That would. Did you have something to say about that, Kokyo? Oh, okay. I. So we kind of understand what skillful means is. It's not so new, but there's a little bit of a twist here. Let's see. How do I get down there? I do it this way. Let me see where I've underlined things. So let's start. Shariputra is saying, maybe start with Shariputra there. Do you want to read there, Kokyo, Shariputra, the insight?
The insight of the Tathagata is broad and great, profound and far-reaching, immeasurable, unexpected, with power, with courage, with meditation, with liberation, and with concentration, have enabled him to enter into the boundless and to fulfill the unprecedented Dharma. By making a variety of distinctions, Shariputra, the Tathagata is able to teach the great skill, cheering the hearts of all with gentle words.
These distinctions are people are ready to hear at different levels or in different places.
In some, Shariputra, the Buddha has fulfilled the whole Dharma, innumerable, unlimited, unprecedented teachings. This is enough, Shariputra. No more needs to be said. Why? Because the Buddha has achieved its most rare and difficult to understand. Only among Buddhists, but only a Buddha and a Buddha, can the true character of all things be fathomed. This is because every existing thing has such characteristics, such a nature, something about it.
Okay. So Shariputra has asked him, you know, what's going on here? And the Buddha says, you know, Buddhas understand a lot of things, but it's really too complicated to explain. And so I'm going to stop right here. And the Buddha is going to try to teach carefully, the Buddha has said, with these distinctions, with skillful means, but I can't say the whole thing right now because it's just too much. So I'm going to stop right here, but this is enough, Shariputra. And he says, only Buddhas, among Buddhas, and what Kokyo said is Dogen, and perhaps in another translation, it says, only a Buddha with a Buddha can understand the true nature of all things. And that's one of Dogen's, the title of one of Dogen's fascicles, Only a Buddha with a Buddha, or Only a Buddha and a Buddha. And it comes right from this.
He even has another fascicle called The True Character of All Things. So that sentence is a big one for Dogen.
Yes. And then what he says is that I stopped Kokyo saying, everything is too difficult. Only Buddhas among themselves can really kind of understand. And this is because everything has the suchness of characteristics, has the suchness of nature. This is Burton Watson actually uses the word suchness, and Reeves uses such here. But the Buddha is, there's 10 of these suchnesses, and that supposedly are entryways into the suchness of all dharmas. And these are famously called the 10 suchnesses, right here nestled after only a Buddha and a Buddha can understand the 10 kind of entryways into how to understand the nature of all things. These are the 10 suchnesses. But then, Buddha is finally asked 3 times. And finally caves. 81 and 13 is 94. a couple more pages. So he finally agrees. Someone start reading. Do you want to read Lakshmi? Starting with then. Let's see if I can bring my pointer over there. Thousand monks and nuns left the meeting. Why? Because the roots of their sins were so deep and they were so utterly arrogant, and they imagined themselves to already have heard all of the teaching. So these 5,000 people just got up before lecture. Oh, we've heard this Dharma talk before. Oh no, we don't want to do this again. We know all this already. And 5,000 of them left. And the Buddha then said, read that caveat. Now the congregation no longer has the useless branches and leaves, but only the firm, good fruit have stayed. Even the Buddha had his critics. So let's go down. How about Ken? Start with Shariputra there.
Shariputra, meaning of the Dharma that Buddha preaches, appropriate communication is difficult to understand. Why? Because we use a variety of skillful means, causal explanations, and parables to teach. This Dharma cannot be well understood through calculation or analysis. Only Buddha can really grasp it. Why is this? Because it is for the great cause alone that Buddha is the only one to appear in the world.
So this next paragraph is another important one, where the question is, what is the great cause of the arising of Buddhas in the world? And now you can tell us, Ken. What do I mean by saying?
What do I mean by saying is for this one great cause alone that Buddhas, the world-honored ones, appear in the world. The Buddhas, the world-honored ones, appear in the world because they want living beings to open a way to the Buddha's insight and thus become pure. They appear in the world because they want to demonstrate the Buddha's insight to living beings. They appear in the world because they want living beings to apprehend things with the Buddha's insight. They appear in the world because they want living beings to enter into the way of the Buddha's insight. This alone is the one great cause, Shariputra, for which Buddhas appear in the world.
So,
Was this like the first major articulation of this approach? That why Buddha's come is to demonstrate the teaching to other living beings, and so that other living beings can apprehend things, and that other living beings can have insight, and that other living beings can enter the way. I mean, I'm just curious. I'm kind of looking at both of you here, like,
Well, this is certainly a much-cited idea that comes out of the Lotus Sutra. Why do Buddhas appear in the world to teach liberation, to teach the true nature of reality? And when there's a need for that, the Buddhas will arise. Do you have anything to say?
I think there might have been in the Pali canon that why the fucking Buddha appeared to help others.
He was very clear in the Pali canon that I'm here to liberate beings from suffering.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is, you know, not too different from that. He doesn't. This translation doesn't actually say anything about suffering, but it says, you know, I want people to understand the ten suchnesses, the real nature of the universe, and maybe that's a little shift from a person's. I mean, we all know why we personally suffer, and in Buddha's early teaching, you know, kind of dropping our grasping nature, dropping the self, helps us relieves us from suffering. But this is another way that if we really understand the true nature of the universe, that it's empty, that there really nothing there really is nothing to hold on to, and we are all connected. We are all very much not separate from all things. That too is a gateway into our liberation from suffering.
So I'm thinking, correct me if I'm not thinking of words, but I'm thinking that the appearing and the not appearing, you have to appear before anybody notices the not appearing, and maybe that's part of the purpose. And then realizing that there's no appearing and not appearing. Could that, do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Well, appearing and non appearing is usually thought of as the result of causes and conditions in the world. And we certainly enter the concept of emptiness by saying that it's empty of an inherent, non-changing self. But then ultimately, this appearing and non-appearing starts negating even sort of, you know, causes and conditions. So it's pulling us out of that samsaric world where, you know, the Buddha says, because of this, this arises. Because of this, that arises. You know, this kind of one-to-one relationship of samsaric causes and conditions. You know, this arising, this no arising and no disappearing starts negating all of that. Uh-oh. I wonder what that was.
So, maybe this is part of the profound meaning of this ruling of arising, not arising. You cannot do it through the
get
to that.
You don't start there. I mean, skillful means, you know, to understand the no arising and no passing is you kind of have to look at the world for a while and meditate on the world. Do you have any more to say?
About the two bodies of Buddha and it's like the appearing body of the Nirmanakaya. I don't think that's what he's talking about without using those words. Like the Buddhas are inconceivable, but they can appear in the world to help people. Like a person exactly what you do.
Yes, yes.
And also this just to note that this paragraph is in Chinese, it's literally like where it says the one great cause alone, it produces like the causes and conditions of the one great matter, the Daiji, the great matter. And so this is important for delving to, and we use that in the Bodhisattva precept, the causes and conditions of the one great matter. Mm-hmm.
Daiji. And then we'll kind of finish up in these last few minutes on this one final case that's hinted at in if someone could start reading, then the Buddha said to Shariputra.
Then the Buddha said to Shariputra, Buddha does not only teach and transform Bodhisattvas. Their one purpose is to demonstrate the Buddha's insight to all beings and have them apprehended. Shariputra, the Tathagatas teach the Dharma for the sake of living beings only by means of the one Buddha vehicle. They have no other vehicles, no second or third vehicle. Shariputra, the teachings of the Buddhas throughout the universe are all like this.
So here's you know, we've heard of the small vehicle, which is sort of a pejorative for Buddha's fundamental teaching, the Theravadin teaching of the arhats and the liberation from personal suffering. Then the Mahayana actually means a greater vehicle, this bodhisattva practice. With the vow being to save all beings before we save, before we liberate ourselves, before we cross into nirvana. There's a sometimes it's said that a third vehicle is the Pratyeka Buddha, these people that kind of without joining a monastery, without working with a teacher, they just start understanding the true nature of the world. So kind of self-taught monks, people that are self-taught the party. So that's sometimes thought of as the third vehicle. And so here Buddha is saying, nope, we just have this one Buddha vehicle. We don't have those other three. And this one Buddha vehicle is, you know, teaching the great matter, teaching the true nature of reality, teaching, you know, this suchness as a way to liberate ourselves from suffering and realize our true nature is this one, the one Buddha vehicle. And it goes on to say, which we can look at next week and expand on next week, that even this, you know, the Shravaka teachings, the Arhat teachings, the original teachings, that wasn't the whole thing. This unsurpassed perfect enlightenment that is held, you know, among the Buddhas. That was skillful means to teach those students. That's really what they could understand in those days. And then even the Bodhisattvas, he's even saying that, you know, even the Bodhisattvas is pretty close. You know, you're going in the right direction if you're studying Mahayana and you're a Bodhisattva. But that's not the whole thing either. He's going to tell us a little bit more about this one Buddha vehicle. But as Thich Nhat Hanh said in his commentary, that this Buddha is actually using kind speech in a lot of Mahayana sutras, as we see sometimes even with our own Dogen. Dogen kind of puts down, or some of the Mahayana teaching, puts down the original Shravaka teachings in a way that, you know, they don't know nothing. They're on the wrong track. We've got the only game in town. Thich Nhat Hanh says the Buddha is using kind speech here and saying, you know, all of you are going to get full credit for what you know. Like your credits are going to be able to be transferred to the new university. You'll get full credit for all of your practice. And what we're all going to be learning here is this one Buddha vehicle, the Ekka Buddha Kaya, the Ekka Buddha Yana. The one Buddha vehicle is what we're all going to be now. And people are going to love it. So we'll end here as everything, maybe it means I haven't touched the computer. So it gives itself a break. We will continue this discussion on the one Buddha vehicle. But what I'd like for people to do, you can actually, if you don't want to buy a book of any translation you'd like, you know, you can go to Logos. Logos has some of the older translations at a good price. But I'm going to continue to flash this Reeves translation. But you can also find free translations online. I looked at a couple of them that are pretty good. And you can download a PDF of the whole Lotus Sutra, and that can keep you going. And I'd like people to sort of take on the next, because they all tell different stories. So if somebody could kind of be in charge of chapter 3, that'll tell us the parable of the burning house. Chapter 4, which will be the parable of the medicinal herbs. I think am I right about that chapter? Who wants to do the burning house chapter 3? Yeah, you can take it for. No, chapter 4 is faith and understanding. Some more parables. Number 5 is the parable of the plants or the medicinal herbs. You wanted to do that one? Michael, why don't you read the Burning House, chapter 3. Charlie, are you going to be around next? So take a look at those next chapters. They have lots of stories, and we'll go through all of them. But if someone could just give a couple of, we'll have a couple of reports. We'll hear about the burning house, and we'll hear about the medicinal herbs next week. If you'd like to take the Fantastic City, chapter 7. Do you have a favorite, Edie?
Doesn't matter what book you use.
You can use any book you can find. You can go online too if you've got that.
Also, we have quite a few copies in the library of all different translations of the Lotus Sutra.
Yeah. And I've got. Do you want to borrow my Burton one?
Yeah.
Totally. You can take the Burton one, and in what chapter? You can do number 6. Yeah. And Charlie, do you want to take the Kern there?
I'll find it.
Okay. Yeah.
I think I actually downloaded this version online. It's pretty similar. I'm overwhelmed by the number of pages.
Kokyo obviously did.
I don't remember where, but
yeah. So yeah, there are some online. Thank you very much. This was a lot of fun.